Hi, my name is Erica Ewing, and I'm a senior attorney at IJ.
And I'm Diana Simpson. I'm an attorney here at IJ.
When society has a problem, who do most people think should be the one to fix it? Any guesses? That's right, the government. Okay, maybe not most people in this room, but most other people. But as we all know, a lot of times the government is not able to fix public problems. Other times, we don't even want them to try. As Ronald Reagan said, the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." Believing in small government means that we believe if we have any hope of shrinking government size, we have to give private parties the space to create solutions on their own. Whether those private parties are businesses or charities or some combination of both, they can often do it a lot more efficiently than the government can and without spending taxpayer money. Sometimes they could even turn a profit.
But what happens when the government won't allow for private solutions? Increasingly, we are seeing people developing unique solutions to persistent public problems, only to be shut down because their solution is too creative for the government's rigid regulatory scheme, or maybe because their solution isn't how the government would have done it themselves. And that's where IJ steps in. We are more than happy to push the government out of the way. And we are taking on these cases and winning. Our cases involve private citizens stepping up to solve some of society's most complex public problems, including homelessness, hunger, the housing crisis, animal welfare, and education. This is a newer area of work for us, but it is taking off. Just in the last 2 years, we have had 5 cases in 4 states. We've won one, we've lost one, and we're fighting hard in the cases that are currently pending. And these numbers don't count our other successful work in the area, like litigation by letterhead and getting opinion pieces published in the national newspapers that often encourage the government to do the right thing.
So let's start with our first case in Assateague County, Washington. Assateague County is a very poor area. Kathy Hay had lived there all her life, and she wanted to do something to help the low-income and homeless people in her neighborhood. So she built a little free pantry and put it in her backyard. Her backyard actually backs up to a public alley, but it's entirely on private property. Now, right away, this was a success. Kathy started putting food in the pantry, and multiple people came every day to take the food. Her neighbors even started putting food to share in there themselves. But the county was not happy. They did not like the pantry. In their view, the pantry couldn't possibly be safe, because it didn't comply with the state food code, which is hundreds of pages long. So the county ganged up with the state, and they teamed up against Kathy and shut the pantry down. And that's the close notice on the pantry right there. So we sued, and we argued that Kathy should be able to share safe food, like prepackaged foods and fresh produce, without having to comply with a whole bunch of government regulations. After only a few months of litigating the case, the government was forced to agree with us. They threw in the towel. And our victory not only... Yeah, we can clap. And our victory not only made Kathy's pantry legal, but it legalized pantries across the entire state. So our next case is 1,000 miles south in Bullhead City, Arizona. There we're fighting the arrest of an 87-year-old grandmother. Her crime? Feeding the homeless in a public park.
I think this is PR unfair, but okay. Here's the bad news. You must go to court. Do not come back into the park and beat people. If you do, you will definitely spend the night in jail. I'm never going to stop beating them. Never.
Norma, I want to thank you so much for joining us. What you're doing in that video seems really personal to you. Can you tell me why you feed others?
Well, when we're told to in the Bible, God says so. But mostly because in my life and from the time I had kids and during their time, there have been times that if it hadn't been for somebody with a kind heart, my kids would have had nothing to eat. I mean, there have been really lean times.
And so from that, you decided to reach back and help people once you were in a better spot.
Yeah, I've done it off and on almost all my life.
Well, that's wonderful. So you're in Arizona now, but that's not where you're originally from. What brought you to Arizona?
Well, I keep saying it was stay with my husband or get a divorce, and I don't believe in divorce, so...
So when you were, before you came to Arizona, you owned a restaurant in Alaska, is that right?
Yes, I did, for almost 20 years.
So you had more than 20 years of experience as a restaurateur.
As an owner, and then I worked in restaurants for about 18, 20 years before that.
So you know your way around the kitchen.
Yes, I do.
So now you're in Bullhead City, Arizona. Can you tell us a little bit about Bullhead City?
Not a whole lot, because I don't do much there. It's right on the Colorado River, right Nevada and California and Arizona meet. It's just a town that's growing very rapidly. It's mostly retirement.
Okay. Town. Is there poverty in Bullhead City?
Yes. Yeah, and it's getting worse every day.
And so are there shelters and food pantries to help those in need?
Just before I was arrested, they have opened a shelter, the first one there. And they do a good job. It just isn't quite enough, and it's too far away for those that I do help.
So there's not quite enough to go around for everyone who needs it.
Correct.
And so this is where you stepped in, and you started feeding other people. Can you please tell us a little bit about that?
I'm not quite sure how to tell you. Cook food in my own home. I wouldn't take anything that I wouldn't feed to my children or my grandchildren. I take and box it all up, and I take it. Well, now I don't take it to the park, but I used to take it to the park. We had a lovely, there was grass, and there were tables with roofs over them to protect you from the rain or the sun. And they could sit down, they'd get their food, and they'd sit down and have a balanced meal. I make sure that we have a good balanced meal with a main dish, with salad or vegetables, and a dessert. And try to keep it in a nice, even balance, good, healthy food. And then they would go around and police the area, pick all of the trash and everything up, and I'd haul it away. I mean, we didn't leave any footprint at all. And the reason for the park is it's the only place in the north part of Bullhead that there's place to wash your hands and restrooms. So it just was a good place.
Can you give me an example of a meal you served last week?
What did I do? Oh, I made a strata.
Ooh.
It was kind of funky, but I had extra spinach. And so it was a spinach and sausage and three cheese strata. And we took that. We had a nice green salad that went with it. We had Jell-O with fresh peaches and bananas and blueberries and every kind of fruit I could get that day.
That sounds wonderful.
And then, of course, we they had some sauces and different things to put on them. Some of them liked the hot sauces.
Well, that sounds wonderful. So can you tell us a little bit about the people that you serve?
Oh, my. Some of them are homeless and live in the desert. I have a couple of families that have children that actually have shelter but don't have enough money for food all month long. There's, I don't know, probably nearly half now are people that do have housing or a vehicle. And if you have a vehicle, you're not homeless, by the way. They come because they just don't have enough food. And the ones that do have housing are in, some of them are in like it's a hotel, and they've converted it to rent by the month. And all they have is one room, a microwave, and a little mini refrigerator, and a bathroom.
Right.
Which is better than the desert. But.
Certainly. So I know that in many cities around the country right now, there's a concern about homeless encampments. And so was that an issue here? Do homeless people sleep in the park that you used to serve in?
Oh, no, no. They would come and worship, use the restroom, and like that. Some would do some fishing in the river. No one sleeps in the park. But mostly they didn't even hang out there much at the park. When it was extremely hot, they would kind of be off over under the trees. But they don't necessarily like to be out in the public, the ones that, you know, that I know. They kind of stay off to themselves.
So you were serving these people for a fair amount of time. Mm-hmm. How did people in the city react to this?
Well, there were a few people that would drive by and call me dirty names and say bad stuff. But for the most part, nobody bothered much of anything. And I knew that at one point the city had talked about making an ordinance against it. And even I went and talked to the council, you know, against it, along with about 30 or 40 other people that said, this is wrong. All we're doing, because there were some other people that were doing the same thing other days, and all we're doing is just giving them nutritious food, and you know, so, but, yeah.
So in 2021, the city enacted an ordinance that all but prohibited people from sharing prepared food in any public park if it was done for a charitable purpose. So people can serve food in the park at a birthday party with their friends all they'd like. But as soon as they serve people who are in need, they can be arrested if they don't follow the city's extremely restrictive conditions. So, Norma, how did you learn about the law?
Well, it's kind of funny. We just finished up serving. Actually, my husband had came with me that night and was helping me do. And two police officers, one in a pickup and one in a car, drove up. And the one man got out and he says, said hello, and I said hi, and he says, can I ask what you're doing? And I says, I'm just picking up and getting ready to leave. I fed the homeless tonight. He goes, oh, he says, do you know there's a law against that? And I go, no. And he says, well, let me see your ID and like that. And I said, oh, okay, sure. Went and got my ID out of the car and handed it to him, and he went to his truck, and he came back, and he says, I'm going to have to put you under arrest. And I go, okay. And this went kind of back and forth. He said, well, let me double check. And they went back and got on this radio and talked to somebody, and they came back again, and he says, yeah, I'm going to have to take you in. And so he put me in the car, actually it was a pickup, and it's like the seat's like made out of wood. I mean, it's just the hardest thing you've ever sat on in your life. And he did not handcuff me. He was very nice. He says, I don't think you want to hurt me. And I says, oh, no, I don't want to hurt anybody. And they cinch you down so tight you can hardly breathe.
Oh, my.
And they come around and got back in the truck and was talking to somebody on the phone. I couldn't really hear him. And boom, another car drove up. He got out, went over, and was talking to this other person. And I heard it was chief of police. Now, I don't really know that for sure. And he come and he opened the door and he says, well, and I says, I'm not going to have to take you in, but you have been officially arrested, and you'll have to go to court. Okay, and he put on the paper when I had to go to court and everything.
So were you eventually convicted of anything?
No.
So the city ended up dismissing your case after we got involved a little bit and got an op-ed published that shamed the city.
Yeah.
And so... But they told you that they would arrest you again if you ever did this again.
And I
right?
didn't. I've never, ever since. I've taken water because they cannot stop you. Arizona law says that if someone comes homeless or otherwise to your business or to a shop, and at no time can you turn water away. If they ask you for a drink, it's against the law to not. But food, no.
So did you stop serving people?
No.
So where are you serving today?
Today, I am permission. They told me that they couldn't do anything if I do it at a church or on private property. Well, this wonderful gentleman that has a jet ski rental has let me use the backside of his property, and I am serving. I bring my tables, and I set it up, and we put the food there, and serve them, and they sit on the ground just in the dirt and lean up against a fence for a bit of shade.
So up here on the screen, is this the alley you're serving food in now?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it looks like the only shade comes from this chain link fence. Mm-hmm. Rocky area, and Bullhead City's pretty hot, isn't it?
128 degrees this summer.
Oh my goodness.
For a lot of days.
And so this is where you're serving now because mm-hmm. they've made it illegal to serve in the public park.
Yes.
Okay, and so before this, you were serving in a park. In fact, this park on the screen now, mm-hmm. This is where you served the needy for several years, isn't that
yes.
correct?
Yes.
And so I see picnic tables, shelter from the sun. Yeah, that actually looks quite nice.
Yeah, they had some beautiful big trees with big shade.
And the public bathrooms are right off to the side, yeah. is that mm-hmm. correct?
Yes.
So, Norma, what is your ultimate goal with what you're doing?
Well, partially it's getting done from time to time is to get as many as we can off of the streets. And you do that through food, and they learn to believe in you and trust you, and you give them a little bit of hope that there can be something better out there. And I've had some success. Ultimately, though, that I would like for myself is to be able to have a place, a piece of land, a building to put up a proper soup kitchen. Not a shelter, but a soup kitchen that I could prepare good food and I could feed them good nourishing food, anyone that needed it. I would not turn anyone down. I don't care if the president came, whether I liked him or not. I would serve him. But and I would never turn anyone down for good food. But I would like to have this so that when it's terribly hot, there would be a place for them to come for cooling. And when the wind is blowing and when the temperature drops down into the low 40s and upper 30s, that's very, very cold to these people because all of them are quite thin and, you know, they're healthy, but they're thin. It's very, you know, it's miserable. So I'd like a place where they could warm up, have a good meal.
Well, that's wonderful. Norma, we are so proud to represent you. And we're in court right now, and we're planning on winning your case and getting you back to that park so that you can serve your neighbors.
So, and I do appreciate you. And I personally would like to thank IJ and all of you donors. You just don't know what an impact you make for all of us. And it goes beyond me and beyond the homeless that I help. To the whole nation, because if we can win this one, it can change it for a lot of people. And I don't advocate homelessness or camps.
Oh, Norma, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
You're wonderful. Oh,
thank you.
Can I done?
This way. Thank you.
So we've been talking about the facts in these cases, but what about the legal claims? Let's talk about them now. We usually bring two types of legal claims in this area, due process and equal protection. The due process clause prevents the government from depriving anyone of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And as the first panel today talked about at length, the Supreme Court has interpreted this clause to protect both rights that are specifically mentioned in the Constitution, as well as rights that are not specifically mentioned. And the Court has also interpreted this clause to provide the greatest protections to what it calls fundamental rights, or rights that are deeply rooted in this nation's traditions and history.
So as Jeff, Anthony, and Rob were talking about earlier today, we at IJ have been looking toward this history, which is replete with people helping others. Charitable acts are central to every major religion and ethical custom. And charity is baked into the American ethos. John Winthrop on the ship Arbella in 1630 shared an ideal that people coming to America would create a city on the hill to serve as an example to others of fulfilling great responsibilities like caring for those in need. Out of charitable impulse, Americans of the founding era ran schools, churches, and other voluntary organizations designed to feed, educate, and help the public. One of the greatest examples is people offering their own land as part of the Underground Railroad, shuttling escaped slaves to the north to freedom by hiding them on private property. We use this history to demonstrate that the Constitution, particularly the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, protects the ability of people to help others without government unnecessarily hindering their efforts. The 14th Amendment is one of this country's most consequential pieces of law.
The second type of claim we bring is an equal protection claim. Now, the Equal Protection Clause mandates that the government has to treat people who are similarly situated equally. Take Norma, for instance. The ordinance that's being enforced her says that you can share prepared food in a public park unless you're doing it for a charitable reason. So you can share the same exact food in the same exact location if you're not doing it for charity and you're instead doing it for a social reason, like having a birthday party. We're arguing that people who are sharing food in a public park are similarly situated to each other, and their motivation for sharing that food should be irrelevant under the law. It shouldn't matter whether the person that you happen to invite to sit down with you is homeless. If it's legal to share food in the park, then everybody should be able to do so. Now, our next case is in North Carolina, and it involves a homeless shelter. This homeless shelter was up against a very hostile town council and a very burdensome zoning code.
The Catherine H. Barber Memorial Shelter has operated for more than 30 years in North Wilkesboro, North Carolina. It provides a warm, safe place for people who are experiencing temporary homelessness due to personal financial crises or family breakdowns. The shelter is run by a voluntary board on a shoestring budget with just a few paid staff members. It hosts, on average, 7 people per night, and it is the only homeless shelter in the entire county. For its first 3 decades, it leased a residential house that had 10 beds. This was often, but not always, enough to serve the community's needs. After a while, the shelter started looking for a new location that had more space. It discovered that the town had recently added a homeless shelter provision to the zoning ordinance, and this added a host of requirements in order to open. As you can see, this included things like being a minimum distance from certain other uses, having a sidewalk, and being a minimum size.
Another requirement that the homeless shelter had to undergo in order to be at its next location was what's called a conditional use permit. Has anyone here had to go through this process? I see a couple of hands. This is an enormous undertaking. It requires the applicant to go in front of a zoning board and have a formal hearing. They have to testify on their own behalf, and their neighbors get to testify either in their favor or against. And the applicant even has to hire a lawyer just to get through this process. Now, the fact that the shelter had to get this permit at all was an anomaly, because there were over 100 other businesses and organizations who were legally allowed to operate in the same location without having to get this permit. And that was, though, even though many of them involved overnight stays, just like the homeless shelter. So we sued. We brought a lawsuit in federal court, and we argued that all these different businesses and organizations who could operate at this location without jumping through all those hoops, that they were similarly situated to the homeless shelter.
And so the shelter had struggled to find a location that could meet all of these requirements. But in 2020, a guardian angel appeared. A local dentist donated his former dental office to the shelter. And the property is absolutely perfect. It's centrally located, and it meets every requirement of the town's homeless shelter ordinance. You can see it up on the screen. And so the shelter submitted its permit application. It thought this application was going to be a lock because the property was in strict compliance with the code. Unfortunately, however, it was not a lock. Nearby property owners did not want a shelter to take root nearby. They portrayed the shelter's clients as criminal predators, addicts, and shiftless beggars who had no desire to improve themselves. But this simply isn't true. The shelter's clients include women escaping domestic violence and people who have been plunged into desperation after losing their jobs. Their goal is to get into permanent housing as quickly as possible. Up on the screen here, you've got Oscar with his parents, Andrea and Matthew, and they are one of the shelter's many success stories.
So the shelter applied for the conditional use permit, and the hearing did not go well. The chair of the zoning board said that even though the shelter met all the requirements of the law, in her words, that didn't necessarily mean that it belonged there. The board then went on to deny the permit, and you cited a bunch of bogus reasons, including that the location was on a sidewalk along a busy road. But if you remember from the requirements before, the law required the shelter to be on a sidewalk along a busy road. So according to the board's interpretation of the law, the shelter wasn't allowed to be anywhere in town. So we sued. We said that the reasons for denying the shelter were pretextual, irrational, and we brought a case in federal court saying that the law and the town's application of the law violated equal protection because it treated the shelter differently from other businesses and organizations.
So our lawsuit relied on a 1985 Supreme Court case called Cleburne. And Cleburne involved a remarkably similar set of facts. There, the city of Cleburne, Texas, denied a similar permit to a home for a dozen intellectually disabled people for bogus reasons. And you can see the home that they were going to use in Texas. It's a perfectly normal-looking home. And so the court addressed each of the city's reasons and saw them for what they were, a smokescreen for the actual reason of simply not wanting a disfavored group of people in town. The courts have treated the Cleburne decision as a relic worthy of the dustbin for years. But it is an example of how courts should approach rational basis review. Don't just take the government for its word, but consider whether the justifications pass the sniff test. And just as in Cleburne, the court in our case found that the government's justifications stunk. It went through each and saw that they were all... Thank you. It went through each of the justifications and saw that they were all exaggerated concerns that would apply to no one but a homeless shelter. And ultimately, it concluded that the town's decision about the shelter meant that a homeless shelter couldn't go anywhere in town. And that's irrational. And so one of our goals with this case was to reinvigorate Cleburne. And we did. The court relied on it heavily in its decision. And we're now citing that decision in our cases all throughout the country. So we've got a quote from that case up on the board here. And so, deference to state zoning regulations cannot be an excuse for the court to abdicate its duty to protect the constitutional rights of all people. North Wilkesboro intentionally treated the shelter differently from other similarly situated uses, and there is no rational basis for the difference in treatment. This is impermissible under the 14th Amendment. I just got chills. And so another one of our goals with this case was to get the shelter open. And after we won, the shelter got hard to work renovating its new home. And I'm happy to report that the shelter opened last month, and they have since served more than 50 people. And so our next examples also involve housing for those in need. But this time, they involve private developers who want to be creative in creating affordable housing.
In the wake of the pandemic, many commercial buildings remain vacant. At the same time, our country has a historic lack of housing. So there's many developers who want to take these two factors and convert commercial properties into residential housing. But the problem is that, you probably guessed it by now, there's a lot of zoning codes out there that make this process so expensive and so complicated that it's virtually impossible to pull off. And that was the case in Richfield, Utah. A developer there had purchased a vacant Motel 6, and at first he rebranded it and was operating it as a motel. But this city had a lot of poverty, it had a shortage of housing, and he quickly realized that what this town needed a lot more than another motel was affordable housing. So he started doing long-term rentals with his rooms for modest rent. His tenants included single moms who were saving up to buy an apartment, people who had just gotten out of rehab, and others who had nowhere else to go besides a homeless shelter. He even had a special part of the motel with extra security measures for women who were fleeing domestic violence so that they could be there and safe. The county recognized that this was a good thing, and the county social services even started dropping people off there who were struggling and saying, "This is the best option for you." And it was. Because not only was this new motel slash apartment, not only was it financially successful, but it quickly became this very special community. The tenants would babysit for each other's kids, AA would hold meetings there, and there were plenty of residents who had been struggling for years, and they were finally able to get back on their feet with the supportive community around them. And you could see this as soon as you walked into this motel. You could see the way that the staff was interacting with the residents and feel the warmth, and it was really touching. But the city didn't like it. The city, frankly, was in denial that it had a poverty problem. They were in denial that they had a housing problem, and they didn't like that this motel was filling the gap. So the city council passed a law that said no motel could rent a room for more than 90 days. This would have kicked many residents out onto the street and probably made a lot of them homeless. So we jumped in. Now, usually when we get involved, we bring a lawsuit. It's actually very therapeutic to sue the government. We love doing it. But you can't always bring a lawsuit. Sometimes you don't have enough time. Sometimes you only have a few days or even a few hours to stop the violation of people's rights. So there's another thing that we do. We have what's called litigation by letterhead, where we'll send a city a letter with very stern wording, and it will say, hey, we don't like what you're doing, and we also really like suing people, so you should probably stop. We coupled this with a press release, and we also had an opinion piece published in the Salt Lake Tribune. It did not take long for the town to throw in the towel. That was a couple of years ago, and to this day, the motel still has the town's official permission to operate as affordable housing.
So earlier, Paul touched on another example of a creative solution to the housing shortage that was suffering from the heavy hand of zoning. In Calhoun, Georgia, we represent a nonprofit called Tiny House Hand Up that wants to build small cottages that they could sell at affordable prices to working-class residents. And here on the screen, we've got Cindy Tucker from Tiny House Hand Up. She's standing on the land that they have secured and want to build on. And here is one of the cottages that they want to build. It's a perfectly normal and attractive house. It's just small. And so the city of Calhoun has a high poverty rate and many residents who are living in unaffordable housing. A few years ago, Cindy got tired of just talking about the problem, and she decided to act. She and a few others founded the nonprofit to fill the void of what they saw as the town's ineffectual efforts to address affordability. A generous donor bestowed on them about 7 acres of land where they planned to start with 6 homes that were about 600 square feet apiece and eventually have about 20 to 30 homes on that land. They have housing plans, financial support from the bank, and contractors at the ready. But the government refuses to get out of their way. Instead, it wants them to build homes that are about twice the size and thus substantially more expensive because it was concerned about attracting riffraff to the town. The city, of course, had no solution to all the supposed riffraff that was already there and had trouble finding stable housing. So we sued, and that case is ongoing now.
So our last case is also takes place in North Carolina, and it involves not homeless people, but homeless animals. So the Dunkel family bought 3.5 acres of land for themselves to live and also to have an animal sanctuary. Now, this animal sanctuary is a really special place. It houses dozens of farm animals, everything from turkeys and rabbits to goats and donkeys. There's a blind dog. And a lot of the animals that the shelter takes care of have special needs. They have disabilities. Take Archie, for instance. Archie is a disabled goat. He was born with his back legs fused together. And that sounds terrible. You know, he has a wheelchair for his back legs. But we got to hang out with Archie a few times, and he was the happiest goat you would ever meet. He would sprint around the farm with his wheelchair. He would follow you around. At night, he would wear pajamas and sleep in the house. And he thought he was a dog. He would, if you stopped petting him, even for a minute, he would headbutt you. Archie had found a very happy home at the sanctuary, along with the dozens of others of animals there. Now, the sanctuary, operated for almost 2 years with no problem at all. No complaints, neighbors loved them, it was great. But then the town decided that its zoning code actually doesn't provide for a sanctuary. It was perfectly legal for them to have their animals there, and lots of neighbors had farm animals, but there wasn't any category in the zoning code that was officially animal sanctuary. So the town said, you know what, you can keep the animals, but you're no longer allowed to have public visits. This was a big problem because the shelter is a 501c3. It's completely supported by donations that the sanctuary gets when people visit. The husband and wife that run it are not taking any salary at all. They're actually putting their money to keep the sanctuary going, and they need donations from public visits. Now, this was also a completely irrational restriction by the city, because as I said, they had been operating for 2 years with no problems, and there was actually a bunch of other businesses and organizations in the same neighborhood that were allowed public visits. Home businesses, daycares, adult homes, and about a dozen other categories. So we sued, and we argued that the town was treating similarly situated people differently. It was treating the shelter worse than other people in the same neighborhood, and we brought a lawsuit in federal court. We actually had a big hearing in this case just a couple of days ago. It went really well, and the judge promised a decision any day now, so fingers crossed.
So to wrap up, this is an important new area for us that is guided by our long-standing principles. We know the goals that we are seeking to accomplish, but we don't yet know what the cases will look like. And that's because these cases are based on American ingenuity. The private sector, whether free market or nonprofit, comes up with solutions to difficult problems all the time. Entrepreneurs are able to react quickly when one technique fails and pivot to a new one. By contrast, government locks in its approach at the beginning and lumbers on without deviation. People should be free, even encouraged, to try out their own solutions to complex public problems. And the government should get out of their way and let them. We are looking forward to finding these cases and standing up for people working to improve society, not just for our clients, but for every person that they are trying to help. Thank you.